If you have a smart speaker, you have access to the entire world of NPR and St. Louis Public Radio. All the latest news and all the captivating stories. Activate our voices with yours by telling your smart speaker to play St. Louis Public Radio.
From St. Louis Public Radio. This is Politically Speaking. 16 years ago, Bob Onder lost a bitterly contested Republican primary for Congress to Blaine Lucht-Meyer. But earlier this year, Onder prevailed in the race to succeed Lucht-Meyer and could have punched his ticket to Washington, D.C. On the latest episode of Politically Speaking, Onder breaks down the big issues he may confront in 2025 and talks about Republican expectations around Amendment 3, which would legalize abortion in Missouri. Let's hit the music.
This is the Politically Speaking podcast, the definitive show about Missouri politics.
My promise to St. Louis was that I would do the absolute most for each and every person, starting with those who have the very least.
What I wanted to do was look and see what other states are doing.
We have to be willing to change those laws, that they are balanced and they affect everybody equally.
As somebody that grew up in the St. Louis area, in North St. Louis County, I didn't know any lawyers growing up.
We got to find long-term solutions to make government better, but also to be able to provide services to people.
I don't want to leave that federal money that we've been leaving all these years on the table.
We need to be spending this money to take care of Missourians.
I thought we accomplished a lot this year, but a lot more needs to be done.
And welcome to Politically Speaking. I'm your host, St. Louis Public Radio political correspondent Jason Rosenbaum. Joining me from, I believe, St. Charles County, unless he is somewhere else in the 3rd Congressional District, he's the Republican nominee for Missouri's 3rd Congressional District.
Hi, Bob Onder. Great to be on with you, Jason.
Great to be on with you again. I guess I can just call you Dr. Onder since you are no longer in the Missouri Senate, but you may be Representative Onder again.
Yes.
After many years of a layoff from that. So you and Kurt Schaefer and a number of other candidates ran in August. You won by 10 percentage points. I think that Donald Trump's endorsement had a lot to do with it, but why do you think that you are in this position now where you are finally on the precipice of becoming a member of Congress?
Yeah, it was, of course, a hard-fought primary battle. A lot of money spent on both sides. Here in Missouri, I outraised my opponent about 3-1, but a lot of money was from across the country was brought to bear on the race. At the end of the day, I think the reason for my success was where I was best known, which was St. Charles County, Jefferson County, Washington County, Crawford County. I won overwhelmingly. And in my home county of St. Charles, I won by 42 points. Whereas less known, some of the attack ads had more effect. But at the end of the day, I'm going to represent the entire district, suburban and rural alike, central Missouri, as well as Jefferson and St. Charles County. But at the end of the day, I think our conservative message, our America First message did break through. And the voters decided by a healthy margin to choose me as the Republican nominee. 47% of the vote in a 7-way race is not bad.
Given the history between you and Congressman Lucht-Meyer, and for listeners who were not paying attention in 2008, like Dr. Onder and I were, you two ran against each other in a very bitter primary where he won. He channeled millions of dollars to try and defeat you. Have you talked with him yet? And are you worried that the transition may be less smooth than usual, given your history?
Yeah, we've reached out to Blaine and his team numerous times, and we've talked to a lot of members of his team. I haven't yet spoken directly to the congressman. I reached out to him a number of times during the campaign trying to talk, but haven't been able to make that happen. I think at the end of the day, I think Congressman Lucht-Meyer very much wanted a successor from Central Missouri, and over the years I supported Blaine after my defeat In 2008, I've gone to his fundraisers. I've introduced him many times at Republican Club events, at Lincoln Days. You know, at the end of the day, he chose Kurt Schaefer. But I think we'll have a smooth transition. It's really important we keep up constituent services to people in the district, veterans who deserve benefits, people who are having trouble with the IRS, people who are having trouble with their passports, or their children are trying to get into a military academy. That kind of stuff should transcend the transition, and I think it will.
So if you win on November 5th, and let's just be brutally honest here, the 3rd Congressional District's a heavily Republican district. You are the favorite to be the next congressman.
Yes.
What are some committees that you would want to serve on?
Yeah. Well, Jason, as you know, in my service in the Missouri legislature, the Missouri Senate, I was very interested in healthcare policy. Healthcare is an important, very important part of our lives and, of course, of the federal budget. So I'd like to serve on committees that would put that to use. And, of course, I had a very strong interest in tax policy. I served on Ways and Means in the legislature for a decade. So probably my number one choice would be to join my good friend, Congressman Jason Smith, Chairman Smith, on the Ways and Means Committee. Many times that's not a committee that a freshman congressman ends up on. I'm very interested in the Education and Workforce Committee, which has a lot of jurisdiction over medicine, as well as labor policy and, as the name implies, education. And then I have a law background, and I served for 8 years as vice chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee in the U.S. Congress, one of the committees most intensely involved in policy concerning the border and security is the Judiciary Committee. I'd like to join Congressman Jordan on the Judiciary Committee.
Yeah, and not to get into too inside baseball, but if you are appointed to the Ways and Means Committee, it is possible you may not get appointed to those other ones, because that is considered like a blue chip committee that oftentimes, like, if you get appointed to it, that is your main focus. But also because it's a very expansive committee as well. So I want to make that clear.
There's a lot of important policy and is a lot of work. Yes, the so-called A-tier committees like Ways and Means and Energy and Commerce, I think that's usually a congressman's only appointment. Yes.
So the last 2 years, the House Republicans have been divided between, like, the Freedom Caucus and leadership. And frankly, like, the Freedom Caucus hasn't even been united. Like, Marjorie Taylor Greene got kicked out of it. And look, I am not naive when it comes to legislative politics. Like, when you have divided government where the Senate's controlled by the Democrats and the White House is controlled by the Democrats, a Republican House with a very slim majority is not going to be able to do everything it wants. Like,
right.
I get it. And I'm not going to take those variables away. But do you think that this division that we saw is going to continue into 2025, and that's going to impede Republicans from being able to do any of their big ideas, especially if, like, Trump wins and he's going to have an agenda that he's going to want to carry out?
Yes, you're right, Jason. As your question implies, in a narrowly divided government, it is going to be really important for House Republicans to work together, and not every bill is going to be perfect. You know, and of course, extreme of absurdity is for, say, 7 or 8 Republicans to join all the Democrats to unseat a Republican speaker. That is not productive. It is important that those of us who are fiscal conservatives, that we work hard to advocate for our principles and to get the best possible bill we can. But at the end of the day, the division within the Republican caucus, that's not a good thing.
So from that answer, I get a sense that you would be very similar in practice to Congressman Eric Burleson, who's a member of the Freedom Caucus, but did not vote to remove McCarthy, and actually voted for McCarthy multiple times, even though some people like Matt Gaetz did not support McCarthy at all. You wouldn't have been one of the people who had tried to oust him based off that answer.
Yeah, no. I mean, I think, look, I, you know, I wasn't there during the speaker's election and all of that. But at the end of the day, we do have to elect our leadership. We have to elect the best, most effective leader we can. And then it's an internal caucus decision as to who that leader is going to be. So joining up with all the Democrats to oust a leader that you don't view as being perfect, that's not the right thing to do. It's not very smart. You'll notice Nancy Pelosi on many issues, she got every single Democrat member of the House in line, and they walked in lockstep and they got things done. Bad things done, but they got things done. I believe we Republicans, many of us are more independent minded by temperament, maybe by background. A lot of us are small business people and we're used to, no, it's got to be done this way. But you've got to learn to work as a team. And I think we will. I think with the caucus has learned some lessons about the last couple of years. And I really do think we're going to have a successful first 100 days, because it is important. If we get that so-called trifecta, the presidency, the House, and the Senate, in the first 100 days, we're going to have an agenda to secure the border, an agenda to renew the 2017 Donald Trump tax cuts. We need to have an agenda to restore sane energy policy and, you know, reassert strength abroad. And I think we're going to be united on that. I think we're going to do it, and the American people will be very happy they returned Republicans to power in Washington.
Let's talk about some of those issues. I want to start off with illegal immigration, since your claim to fame when you were in the Missouri House was passing a very impactful illegal immigration bill, which banned sanctuary cities. I know I've told you this before, and I'll say this publicly. One of my favorite things in Missouri politics is when somebody goes and on the air and says, I will ban sanctuary cities in Missouri. And I always am like, Bob Onder banned them in 2008. So all you have to do is like get sworn in and you have banned sanctuary cities. So,
yes, yeah.
I'm sure you find that humorous as well.
But. Yeah, we did, Jason. Yeah, so the 2008 bill, and we were, you know, I sometimes say I was fighting illegal immigration before Donald Trump was, but no, we passed the strongest state law in the country to fight illegal immigration, with the possible exception of Arizona. I was invited to talk to FAIR, the Federation for American Immigration Reform's National Convention, because it was such a great bill. We did a number of things: banning sanctuary cities, requiring local law enforcement to cooperate with ICE. Of course, the whole sanctuary city ban is, again, requiring local governments to cooperate with ICE, cracking down on catch and release, and then, of course, cutting off welfare benefits to illegal aliens. We did those things, but all those things imply a federal government that is enforcing immigration law. So we can have a ban on sanctuary cities in Missouri, but the Biden-Harris administration has made every city a sanctuary city because ICE will not talk to local law, will not cooperate with local law enforcement. I've talked to sheriffs around the district, and I'll be representing 16 counties in Congress. I've talked to sheriffs, and they will detain illegal aliens, always having committed crimes or suspected of having committed crimes, try to turn them over to ICE, but ICE will not take them. So where does that leave local law enforcement? So it is critical we again restore the functioning of ICE, just its core functions. We don't need new laws necessarily passed, but we do need to then also restore the remain in Mexico policy, the policy of not catching and releasing into the population, illegal aliens. Being able to pronounce the word asylum shouldn't mean you automatically get to stay here. We need to restore a sensible asylum process. And of course, we need to complete the border wall, which is where President Trump will need funding from Congress. We can do all those things. We can do all those things in the first 100 days, but it's going to require Republican control of the House. And that's why since my victory in August, I've been working so hard to help Republican members, candidates around the country to maintain and grow our majority in the U.S. House.
Let's go through a couple of those issues you mentioned, like the asylum process. So there's been a lot of focus, especially by former President Trump, on Venezuelans, like in Colorado, for example.
Right.
And I am not arguing that if somebody commits a crime that they should be able to stay in the country. But the tricky thing is, specifically with Venezuela, is anybody that comes across the border now from there could make a legitimate asylum claim that they are fleeing political persecution, because Venezuela now has a dictator that stifles political dissent worse than, probably even worse than Hugo Chavez did, to be very candid with you. So What is the process to make sure that you are filtering out people that may have committed crimes here or committed crimes in Venezuela with people who are genuinely fleeing political persecution?
Of course, it's not easy because we don't have access to Venezuelan criminal records. So it's almost impossible to properly vet people from these other countries. But last I checked my map, Jason, the United States does not share a border with Venezuela. So it is not our job as the United States of America to take everyone who doesn't get along with their government. You know, this world is full of totalitarian regimes, some of which are quite brutal. We cannot take every person from all of those countries. So somehow a Venezuelan getting to the U.S. border is crossing other countries. They need to stay in those other countries along the way. And then if we can work out their petition for asylum while they remain in Mexico, for instance, and we determine they are a legitimate political refugee, that's great. We can consider welcoming them to the United States. But actually, I was actually at an event, last night with Treasurer Malik, and the majority of the people there were immigrants, some of whom he had represented in their immigration battles to come to the United States legally. And uniformly, the men and women in this room said, hey, it took me 16, 17 years to come to the United States illegally. It is obscene that we are tolerating this invasion of our southern borders.
You mean to come in legally? I want to make sure. They took them 16, 17 years to come in legally.
Come there legally. Yes, yes. And many of these individuals were from the Asian subcontinent, India, Pakistan. And they came legally. Many of them were physicians. Some of them were in information technology professionals. But they came legally to our country. They came here to pursue jobs, to pursue careers. They were not trafficking fentanyl. 100,000 Americans have died in the last year of fentanyl poisoning, almost all of it coming across our southern border made with precursors from China. We have records amounts of human trafficking, including child sex trafficking. All of this is enabled by the Biden-Harris open borders policy. So the number one thing we can do to secure our border is to elect Donald Trump in November.
Now, I want to talk about why some of those cases take so long to get resolved. And that's because the immigration courts seem insanely backlogged. So let's bring up an example in St. Charles County, which is just a horrible situation all around. So Officer David Lee was killed when somebody from St. Charles County who had pled guilty to domestic battery in 2022 after being arrested for it in 2020, slammed into the car and killed this officer. Okay. And I talked with Prosecutor McCullough about this, and basically what happened is the immigration folks already knew he was in the country, and it was taking years for him to get a case because the immigration courts are so backlogged. And one of the things I just don't understand is, like, I understand there are things in that, like, bill that Kamala Harris keeps talking about that you don't like and you wouldn't have supported. But one of the things that doesn't seem controversial is hiring more immigration judges and more immigration prosecutors. Why can't Republicans and Democrats just do that as a standalone bill and like move the process along for someone like the gentleman I mentioned, whose case should have been adjudicated much faster than it did, basically?
Well, you know, I'll answer your question. Why can't Republicans and Democrats do it? We absolutely should. But not only will the Democrats not do it, even when they got their funding, $64 billion to Ukraine, not a penny of border security money was included, not a penny for these immigration courts. So all I can conclude from that is that it is the policy of the Democrat Party in Congress and certainly of the Biden-Harris administration to facilitate open borders. The bill, the only reason Kamala Harris likes the bill she keeps talking about is it essentially was an open borders bill. It would allow approximately a million illegal aliens in the year before it shut down our border, and even then the president could keep the border open. So it was that bill was a joke, even though it had some funding in it. But we don't need to completely. There are, look, believe me, there are things broken about our immigration system, but to secure our border, and the bottom line is not, these people shouldn't be coming across the border anyway. The border wall should be intact. Texas, the state of Texas, have secured the border. They've solved the crisis or dramatically reduced illegal crossings. But you're right; we should be detaining and deporting these criminal illegal aliens much more quickly.
We'll be right back after this quick break with congressional candidate Bob Onder.
The Gateway brings you the day's news each weekday from around the St. Louis region and the state capitals in Jefferson City.
Our schools are accredited. We don't need this bill.
And Springfield.
How many more years must pass before lawmakers see time is of the essence?
I'm Abby Larico. Join me each weekday for The Gateway on the STLPR app or wherever you get podcasts.
And we're back on Politically Speaking with Bob Onder. He is the Republican nominee in the 3rd Congressional District. You mentioned Ukraine, and especially if Kamala Harris wins, I would imagine that continued aid to Ukraine will continue to be an issue. This is something that has divided your caucus. People like Congresswoman Ann Wagner have been strong supporters of Ukraine funding. And then most of the Republican House caucus besides her from Missouri have been opposed to it. Where do you fall down on that continuum?
Yeah. Well, Jason, let me first say that, you know, in this Ukrainian war, there's no question that the aggressor, the bad guy, is Vladimir Putin and Russia. And I think the whole world cheered, including myself, when Putin failed in his goal of overrunning Ukraine in a week or whatever his time frame was. But we are now in this fight for over 2 years. We're up to a total of a million casualties, dead and wounded, probably at least 70, 80 dead on both sides of the conflict. The average Russian and Ukrainian conscript these days tends to be in their 40s. And the United States has spent $175 billion on what's essentially amounted to a proxy war. I agree with President Trump that it is time for a negotiated settlement. This bloodshed, this destruction, and this massive expenditure of American tax dollars to a pretty unaccountable regime has got to end. But look, do I want to abruptly cut Ukraine off? No, but I think it's going to take a strong leader in the White House to negotiate a settlement. And I think that can be done.
Why are there some people in your caucus, and I'll mention Marjorie Taylor Greene again, but I'll mention Tucker Carlson, that seem to imply that Russia was the aggrieved party and that Ukraine is this evil, anti-Semitic, awful place and look, I'm not unbiased here. I'm half Ukrainian and half Polish. I don't trust Russia, But I am mystified by how some people in your party have been carrying Russia's water. And you mentioned, and you're not one of them. You just mentioned that. Why is that happening? Because I frankly don't get it.
Yeah. Yeah, there is among some this idea that Vladimir Putin is, you know, some sort of a conservative. He's kind of an American or a Russian version of, I don't know, Donald Trump or Ronald Reagan. I think he does play the kind of social conservative card pretty well. But he's a brutal dictator. He suppresses dissent and even evidence is pretty good. Even murders some of his political opponents. But look, I think there are no choir boys on either side of this conflict. I think the aid to Russia, aid to Ukraine, has not had the kind of accountability we'd like to see. I think the idea that that NATO has to keep expanding and expanding. I mean, we could only imagine if there were still a Warsaw Pact around, and all of a sudden Canada and Mexico wanted to join it. Russia has had had access to a warm water port in Crimea for centuries. So I think there are interests on both sides. There are definitely bad guys on both sides. And I think it's just time for this conflict to end. And I think the right leadership in the White House will be able to make that happen.
Let me ask you this question on Israel. Israel is one of the best economies in the world. They have plenty of money to where they could buy their own weapons without us giving them to them, which is a similar argument that a lot of Republicans are making about Ukraine. Why do we have to keep giving them weapons as opposed to just asking them to pay for it? Like, that's the part I don't understand, that dichotomy of Republicans that don't want to give weapons to Ukraine, but then are just willing to give Israel anything they want without paying for it when they can pay for it.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and Israel does pay for some of their weapons, but you are right; they do get a large amount of aid. I think perhaps the thing that makes Israel different is that they are really one of the only actual democracies in the Middle East. They are part of the Judeo-Christian Western tradition that we in the United States belong to. But that over the decades, they have been our staunchest ally, not only now during the War on Terror, but also during the Cold War in the United Nations. Often Israel will be the only member voting with the United States. And of course, Israel in recent days, we just celebrated, or rather mourned, the 1 year anniversary of the massacre on October 7th, which killed 1,200, including 46 Americans. I think Israel is a unique situation. But look, I would say of all our foreign allies, they need to pay, need to carry their own weight, and to the extent that they can afford, the weaponry that we are capable of selling them, they ought to buy it.
Let's talk about abortion, an issue that you have been passionate about for your entire life, not just your political career. I'll be very candid. I don't really see a path right now where Congress will be able to pass a law either legalizing abortion everywhere or curtailing it everywhere. Especially without a trifecta, it's impossible. And even with a trifecta, I don't think it's going to happen in the Senate. So let's just leave. I think we need to put that context out there. But I think a question that often gets brought up to congressional candidates is, if you had a bill in front of you that would say, let's say every state has to have a 15-week limit on abortions, what would be kind of your thought process on that, given that one of the things we heard before Roe versus Wade fell from Republicans is this should be a state issue. This shouldn't be a federal issue. States like Missouri should be able to have very restrictive laws. States like Illinois can have or very few restrictions. Where do you kind of fall in the continuum of like the federal government standardizing abortion laws, like I just mentioned?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. No, very, very, uh, Very complex question, and you're right. You know, so for 50 years, there was a famous Time magazine cover, I think about 10 years ago, that said in 1973, abortion rights forces won an epic victory with Roe versus Wade, and they've been losing ever since. You know, and we're almost on the other, the shoe's almost on the other foot right now, unfortunately. But it captured something. Over the last 50 years, pro-lifers in many states, of course, including Missouri, have had a series of victories, you know, whether it be health and safety regulations, supporting pregnancy care centers to allow women to choose life for their unborn child. And of course, even bans and even a national ban on that very hideous practice of partial birth abortions. So there is precedent for federal abortion law in that bill. So in general, I think the police powers under our federal system, the police powers, even things not only abortion, but things like laws about murder and rape and armed robbery are by and large state laws, not federal. So I think the appropriate place for that policy, that state policy to be made is in the states. I agree with you that there are not the votes in Congress to ban abortion or votes in Congress to reinstate Roe versus Wade. But look, if an abortion restriction were in front of me, I'd be a yes vote.
I've talked with you about Amendment 3. I know you're a very big no on it.
Yes.
I'll be very honest with you. I've talked with a lot of Republicans about Amendment 3, and they tell me all sorts of horrible scenarios that could occur if it passes. But I haven't found many who think it's going to fail. Like, there is a expectation that it could pass. And what it comes down to is that the current law in Missouri, which does not have a window at all, there's no 6 weeks like in Florida, and there's no rape or incest exceptions. That just seems too much, even for Republicans that do not like the concept of legal abortion. Do you have the same fear that people like you who passed this law in 2019 may have overreached and may have put Missouri in a position to where, like, even if we don't like everything in Amendment 3, we don't like the current law and we're going to vote yes and hope for the best, basically?
Well, Jason, I think if Amendment 3 passes, I don't think it will be those things. I do know some Republicans who would say what you just said, that, you know, I'm pro-life, but I would be okay with certain exceptions. But I don't really think that's the issue here. I think if Amendment 3 passes, it will be a combination of really bad structural problems we have here in the state of Missouri. Number one is a very, very loose initiative petition process. The U.S. Constitution is about 27 pages. Our Missouri Constitution is a couple of hundred. It's become a glorified statute book where any well-funded special interest can come and spend 5, 10, and in this case, $30, $40 million.
Yeah, at this point, it's like $25 million on the pro side.
Yeah.
It is we've talked about this before. It's very similar to stem cells in 2006, yeah, where the no side is being outspent like 25-1, basically, but continue.
And yeah, in 2006, Jason, we were outspent $1 million to $35 million. And actually, we came within 1 point of defeating Amendment 2, which, as many of your viewers remember, put embryonic stem cell research and human cloning research in the Missouri Constitution. So we're going to be outspent, not by quite as bad a margin today, but as in 2006, the ballot language, I believe, is very biased on the pro side, talking very broadly, vaguely about reproductive rights and fertility treatments and care of miscarriages and contraception. None of that is in any way under attack under Missouri law right now. This is about abortion, but it's worded in such a way that any, quote, any restriction, and there's a long litany, restriction, delay, blah, 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 is number one, presumed invalid, and number two, subject to strict scrutiny. So given the very broad, very vague language as to what is, quote, protected, along with the very high standard for any restriction on any of those things. That's where we feel that not only will, you know, it's not going to be just restoring Roe versus Wade. It's going to be abortion in all 9 months of pregnancy, all of our health and safety regs, our informed consent laws, our parental notification and consent laws, and even our restriction against transgender chemical treatments and surgeries for minors. All of those things will be eventually challenged, maybe not on day one, but eventually advocacy groups will come to court and cite amendment number two to strike down those things.
Three
to strike down those things. Do I think, though, that we can still win? I do, because voters, when they feel like they're being deceived or lied to, like they did in 2006 with Amendment 2, and they're certainly being deceived and lied to now with Amendment 3, they tend to default to no. And I think it will be very close, and I'm hopeful we'll be able to defeat that really horrible law.
Okay, I'm not going to say that all the things you mentioned about like abortion being available in 8 or 9 months or gender transition surgery being available for minors without parental consent. I can't predict what courts are going to do. I don't know what the composition of the Missouri Supreme Court is going to be in 1 to 2 years. I don't know what arguments are going to be done. So I cannot predict whether or not those things will come true. But it comes off as very speculative at best. And it also seems to be like it's not really defending the current law. And I think that's kind of the problem that opponents have. It's providing scenarios where you think Amendment 3 could be bad, but it's not saying that this current abortion law that we have should remain in place. That I think is, and I think that's really the big challenge for you all, that like you are trying to defend something that even some Republicans are not comfortable with. So you have to talk about the potential consequences of Amendment 3. Can you address that point for me before I let you go?
Yeah, well, I understand what you're asking, Jason. What I think the point is that what's at question when voters walk into the voting booth and vote on Amendment 3, it's not just a matter of repealing this or that aspect of the current law. It goes much, 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 much further. And that's why I truly believe that Secretary Ashcroft's ballot language was much more accurately reflective of what Amendment 3 does. Look, if pro-abortion advocates just wanted to add exceptions for rape and incest, or they wanted to just restore Roe versus Wade, they could have done so. Remember, all of our health and safety regulations, our parental notification laws, our clinic health and safety regulations to protect Missouri women, our pregnancy care center laws, those all survived scrutiny, judicial scrutiny under Roe versus Wade and under Planned Parenthood versus Casey. All of those laws, as I see Amendment 3, would disappear. So Amendment 3 is truly radical. So it's really the onus on the folks seeking to amend our Constitution is not for me to defend every aspect of, you know, House Bill 126 or any other part of our abortion law. It's to them, why do you want such a broad, expansive attack on our existing pro-life and pro-family and pro-child laws in Missouri? That's what the proponents of Amendment 3 have to ask and answer, and I don't think they can.
Well, Dr. Under, thank you so much for your time. Yeah. And we are planning to have your opponent, Democrat Bethany Mann, on the show so voters in the 3rd District can hear from both sides. Politically Speaking is produced by Sarah Kellogg, Rachel Lipman, and me, Jason Rosenbaum. The show is edited by Fred Ehrlich. Read all of our coverage at stlpr.org. And if you haven't already, make sure to subscribe to Politically Speaking by searching the term Politically Speaking on Apple Podcasts. From St. Louis Public Radio. This is Politically Speaking.